K is for Killer by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1994 by Sue Grafton. This recording of the full-length reading of K is for Killer was published by arrangement with Sue Grafton, care of the Aaron M. Priest Literary Agency, Incorporated, and was produced in 1995 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. The statutory definition of homicide is the unlawful killing of one human being by another. Sometimes the phrase "with malice" is employed, the concept serving to distinguish murder from the numerous other occasions in which people deprive each other of life, wars and executions coming foremost to mind. Malice in the law doesn't necessarily convey hatred or even ill will, but refers instead to a conscious desire to inflict serious injury or cause death. In the main, criminal homicide is an intimate personal affair, insofar as most homicide victims are killed by close relatives, friends, or acquaintances. Reason enough to keep your distance if you're asking me. In Santa Teresa, California, approximately 85% of all criminal homicides are resolved, meaning that the assailant is identified, apprehended, and the question of guilt or innocence is adjudicated by the courts. The victims of unsolved homicides I think of as the unruly dead, persons who reside in a limbo of their own, some state between life and death, restless, dissatisfied, longing for release. It's a fanciful notion for someone not generally given to flights of imagination, but I think of these souls locked in an uneasy relationship with those who have killed them. I've talked to homicide investigators who've been caught up in similar reveries, haunted by certain victims who seem to linger among us, persistent in their desire for vindication. In the hazy zone where wakefulness fades into sleep, in that leaden moment just before the mind sinks below consciousness, I can sometimes hear them murmuring. They mourn themselves. They sing a lullaby of the murdered. They whisper the names of their attackers, those men and women who still walk the earth, unidentified, unaccused, unpunished, unrepentant. On such nights, I do not sleep well. I lie awake, listening, hoping to catch a syllable, a phrase, straining to discern in that roll call of conspirators the name of one killer. Lorna Kepler's murder ended up affecting me that way, though I didn't learn the facts of her death until months afterward. It was mid-February, a Sunday, and I was working late, Little Miss Virtue organizing itemized expenses and assorted business receipts for my tax return. I decided it was time to handle matters like a grown-up, instead of shoving everything in a shoebox and delivering it to my accountant at the very last minute. Talk about cranky. Each year the man positively bellows at me, and I have to swear I'll reform, a vow I take seriously until tax time rolls around again and I realize my finances are in complete disarray. I was sitting at my desk in the law firm where I rent office space. The night outside was chilly by the usual California definition, which is to say, 50 degrees. I was the only one on the premises, ensconced in a halo of warm, sleep-inducing light, while the other offices remained dark and quiet. I'd just put on a pot of coffee to counteract the narcolepsy that afflicts me at the approach to money matters. I laid my head on the desk, listening to the soothing gargle of the water as it filtered through the coffee maker. Even the smell of mocha java was not sufficient to stimulate my torpid senses. 5 more minutes and I'd be out like a light, drooling on my blotter with my right cheek picking up inky messages in reverse. I heard a tap at the side entrance and I lifted my head, tilting an ear in that direction like a dog on alert. It was nearly 10 o'clock, and I wasn't expecting any visitors. I roused myself, left my desk, and moved out into the hallway. I cocked my head against the side door leading out into the hall. The tap was repeated, much louder. I said, "Yes?" I heard a woman's muffled voice in response. "Is this Milhone Investigations?" "We're closed." "What?" "Hang on." I put the chain on the door and opened it a crack, peering out at her. She was on the far side of 40, her outfit of the urban cowgirl sort, boots, faded jeans, and a buckskin shirt. She wore enough heavy silver and turquoise jewelry to look like she would clank. She had dark hair nearly to her waist, worn loose, faintly frizzy, and dyed the color of oxblood shoes. "Sorry to bother you, but the directory downstairs says there's a private investigator up here in this suite. Is he in by any chance?"
Well, more or less," I said. "But these aren't actual office hours. Is there any way you can come back tomorrow? I'll be happy to set up an appointment for you once I check my book."
"Are you his secretary?" Her tanned face was an irregular oval, lines cutting down along each side of her nose, four lines between her eyes where the brows were plucked to nothing and reframed in black. She'd used the same sharpened pencil to line her eyelids, too, though she wore no other makeup that I could see. I tried not to sound irritated, since the mistake is not uncommon.
"I'm him," I said. "Milhone Investigations. The first name is Kinsey. Did you tell me yours?"
"No, I didn't, and I'm sorry. I'm Janice Kepler. You must think I'm a complete idiot."
Well, not complete, I thought.
She reached out to shake hands, and then realized the crack in the doorway wasn't large enough to permit contact. She pulled her hand back.
"It never occurred to me you'd be a woman. I've been seeing the Milhone Investigations on the board down in the stairwell. I come here for a support group once a week down a floor. I've been thinking I'd call, but I guess I never worked up my nerve. Then tonight as I was leaving, I saw the light on from the parking lot. I hope you don't mind. I'm actually on my way to work, so I don't have that long."
"What sort of work?" I asked, stalling. "Shift manager at Frankie's Coffee Shop on Upper State Street, 11 to 7, which makes it hard to take care of any daytime appointments. I usually go to bed at 8 in the morning and don't get up again until late afternoon. Even if I could just tell you my problem, it'd be a big relief. Then if it turns out it's not the sort of work you do, maybe you could recommend someone else. I could really use some help, but I don't know where to turn. Your being a woman might make it easier."
The penciled eyebrows went up in an imploring double arch. I hesitated. Support group, I thought. Drink? Drugs? Codependency? If the woman was Looney Tunes, I'd really like to know. Behind her, the hall was empty, looking flat and faintly yellow in the overhead light. Lonnie Kingman's law firm takes up the entire third floor, except for the two public restrooms, one marked M and one W. It was always possible she had a couple of M Confederates lurking in the commode, ready at a signal to jump out and attack me. For what purpose, I couldn't think. Any money I had, I was being forced to give to the feds at Penpoint. "Just a minute," I said. I closed the door and slid the chain off its track, opening the door again so I could admit her. She moved past me hesitantly, a crackling brown paper bag in her arms. Her perfume was musky, the scent reminiscent of saddle soap and sawdust. She seemed ill at ease, her manner infected by some edgy combination of apprehension and embarrassment. The brown paper bag seemed to contain papers of some sort. "This was in my car. I didn't want you to think I carried it around with me ordinarily."
"I'm in here," I said. I moved into my office with the woman close on my heels. I indicated a chair for her and watched as she sat down, placing the paper bag on the floor. I pulled up a chair for myself. I figured if we sat on opposite sides of my desk, she'd check out my deductible expenses, which were none of her business. I'm the current ranking expert at reading upside down, and seldom hesitate to insert myself into matters that are not my concern.
"What support group?" I asked.
"It's for parents of murdered children. My daughter died here last April, Lorna Kepler. She was found in her cottage over by the mission."
I said, "Ah, yes, I remember, though I thought there was some speculation about the cause of death."
"Not in my mind," she said tartly. "I don't know how she died, but I know she was murdered just as sure as I'm sitting here." She reached up and tucked a long ribbon of loose hair behind her right ear. "The police never did come up with a suspect, and I don't know what kind of luck they're going to have after all this time. Somebody told me for every day that passes, the chances diminish, but I forget the percentage."
Unfortunately, that's true. She leaned over and rooted in the paper bag, pulling out a photograph in a bifold frame. This is Lorna. You probably saw this in the papers at the time. She held out the picture, and I took it, staring down at the girl. Not a face I'd forget. She was in her early 20s, with dark hair pulled smoothly away from her face, a long swatch of hair hanging down the middle of her back. She had clear hazel eyes with a nearly oriental tilt. Dark, cleanly arched brows, a wide mouth, straight nose. She was wearing a white blouse with a long, snowy white scarf wrapped several times around her neck, a dark navy blazer, and faded blue jeans on a slender frame. She stared directly at the camera, smiling slightly, her hands tucked down in her front pockets. She was leaning against a floral print wall, the paper showing lavish, pale pink climbing roses against a white background. I returned the picture, wondering what in the world to say under the circumstances. "She's very beautiful," I murmured. "When was that taken?" "About a year ago. I had to bug her to get this. She's my youngest. Just turned 25. She was hoping to be a model, but it didn't work out."
"You must have been young when you had her."
21, she said. "I was 17 with Berlin. I got married because of her. 5 months gone and I was big as a house. I'm still with her daddy, which surprised everyone, including me, I guess. I was 19 with my middle daughter. Her name's Trini. She's real sweet. Lorna's the one I nearly died with, poor thing. Got up one morning, day before I was due, and started hemorrhaging. I didn't know what was happening. Blood everywhere. It was just like a river pouring out between my legs. I've never seen anything like it. Doctor didn't think he could save either one of us, but we pulled through."
"You have children, Ms. Milhone?"
"Make it Kinsey," I said. "I'm not married." She smiled slightly. "Just between us, Lorna really was my favorite, probably because she was such a problem all her life. I wouldn't say that to either of the older girls, of course." She tucked the picture away. "Anyway, I know what it's like to have your heart ripped out. I probably look like an ordinary woman, but I'm a zombie. The living dead, maybe a little bit cracked. We've been going to the support group. Somebody suggested it, and I thought it might help. I was ready to try anything to get away from the pain. Mace, that's my husband, went a few times and then quit. He couldn't stand the stories, couldn't stand all the suffering compressed in one room. He wants to shut it out, get shed of it, get clean. I don't think it's possible, but there's no arguing the point. To each his own, as they say." "I can't even imagine what it must be like," I said. "And I can't describe it either. That's the hell of it. We're not like regular people anymore. You have a child murdered, and from that moment on, you're from some other planet. You don't speak the same language as other folks. Even in the support group, we seem to speak different dialects. Everybody hangs on to their pain like it was some special license to suffer. You can't help it. We all think ours is the worst case we ever heard. Lorna's murder hasn't been solved, so naturally we think our anguish is more acute because of it. Some other family, maybe their child's killer got caught and he served a few years. Now he's out on the street again, and that's what they have to live with, knowing some fellas walking around smoking cigarettes, drinking beers, having himself a good old time every Saturday night while their child is dead. Or the killer's still in prison, and'll be there for life, but he's warm, he's safe. He gets 3 meals a day and the clothes on his back. He might be on death row, but he won't actually die. Hardly anybody does unless they beg to be executed. Why should they? All those soft-hearted lawyers go to work. System set up to keep them all alive while our kids are dead for the rest of time." "Painful," I said. "Yes, it is. I can't even tell you how much that hurts. I sit downstairs in that room and I listen to all the stories and I don't know what to do. It's not like it makes my pain any less, but at least it makes it part of something. Without the support group, Lorna's death just evaporates. It's like nobody cares. It's not even something people talk about anymore. We're all of us wounded, so I don't feel so cut off. I'm not separate from them. Our emotional injuries just come in different forms." Her tone throughout was nearly matter-of-fact, and the dark-eyed look she gave me then seemed all the more painful because of it.
I'm telling you all this because I don't want you to think I'm crazy, at least any more than I actually am. You have a child murdered and you go berserk. Sometimes you recover and sometimes you don't. What I'm saying is, I know I'm obsessed. I think about Lorna's killer way more than I should. Whoever did this, I want him punished. I want this laid to rest. I want to know why he did it. I want to tell him face to face exactly what he did to my life the day he took hers. The psychologist who runs the group, she says I need to find a way to get my power back. She says it's better to get mad than go on feeling heartsick and defenseless. So, that's why I'm here. I guess that's the long and short of it. Taking action, I said. You bet. Not just talking. I'm sick and tired of talk. It gets nowhere. You're going to have to do a bit more talking if you want my help. You want some coffee? I know that. I'd love some. Black is fine. I filled two mugs and added milk to mine, saving my questions until I was seated again. I reached for the legal pad on my desk, and I picked up a pen. I hate to make you go through the whole thing again, but I really need to have the details, at least as much as you know. I understand. Maybe that's why it took me so long to come up here. I've told this story probably 600 times, but it never gets any easier. She blew on the surface of her coffee and then took a sip. That's good coffee. Strong. I hate drinking coffee too weak. It's no taste. Anyway, let me think how to say this. I guess what you have to understand about Lorna is she was an independent little cuss. She did everything her way. She didn't care what other people thought, and she didn't feel what she did was anybody else's business. She'd been asthmatic as a child and ended up missing quite a bit of school, so she never did well in her classes. She was smart as a whip, but she was out half the time. Poor thing was allergic to just about everything. She didn't have many friends. She couldn't spend the night at anybody else's house because other little girls always seemed to live with pets or house dust, mold, or whatnot. She outgrew a lot of that as she matured, but she was always on medication for one thing or another. I make a point of this because I think it had a profound effect on the way she turned out. She was antisocial, bullheaded, and uncooperative. She had a streak of defiance, I think because she was used to being by herself, doing what she wanted. And I might have spoiled her some. Children sense when they have the power to cause you distress, makes them tyrants to some extent. Lorna didn't understand about pleasing other people, ordinary give and take. She was a nice person, and she could be generous if she wanted, but she wasn't what you'd call loving or nurturing. She paused. I don't know how I got off on that. I meant to talk about something else, if I can think what it was. She frowned, blinking, and I could see her consult some interior agenda. There was a moment or two of silence while I drank my coffee and she drank hers. Finally, her memory clicked in, and she brightened, saying, "Oh, yes, sorry about that." She shifted on her chair and took up the narrative. Asthma medication sometimes caused her insomnia. Everybody thinks antihistamines make you drowsy, which they can, of course, but it isn't the deep sleep you need for ordinary rest. She didn't like to sleep. Even grown, she got by in as little as 3 hours sometimes. I think she was afraid of lying down. Being prone always seemed to aggravate her wheezing. She got in the habit of roaming around at night when everybody else was asleep. Who'd she hang out with? Did she have friends, or just ramble on her own? Other night owls, I'd guess. An FM disc jockey, for one. The guy on that all-night jazz station. I can't remember his name, but you might know if I said it. And there was a nurse on the night shift at St. Terry's, Serena Bonney. Lorna actually worked for Serena's husband at the water treatment plant. I made a note to myself. I'd have to check on both if I decided to help. What sort of job? It was just part-time. 1 to 5 for the city, doing clerical work. You know, typing and filing, answering the telephone. She'd be up half the night, and then she could sleep late if she wanted. 20 hours a week isn't much, I said. How could she afford to live? Well, she had her own little place, this cabin at the back of somebody's property. It wasn't anything fancy, and the rent on that was cheap. A couple of rooms with a bath. It might have been some kind of gardener's cottage to begin with. No insulation. She had no central heating and not a lot of kitchen to speak of, just a microwave oven and a 2-burner hot plate, refrigerator the size of a little cardboard box, you know the kind. She had electricity, running water and a telephone, and that was about the extent of it. She could have fixed it up real cute, but she didn't want to bother. She liked it simple, she said, and besides, it wasn't all that permanent. Rent was nominal, and that's all she seemed to care about. She liked her privacy, and people learned to leave her pretty much alone.
Hardly sounds like an allergen-free environment, I remarked.
Well, I know, and I said as much myself. Of course, by then she was doing better. The allergies and asthma were more seasonal than chronic. She might have an occasional attack after exercise, or if she had a cold, or she was under stress. The point is, she didn't want to live around other people. She liked the feel of being in the woods. The property wasn't all that big. 6 or 7 acres, with a little 2-lane gravel road coming in along the back. I guess it gave her the sense of isolation and quiet. She didn't want to live in some apartment building with tenants on all sides, bumping and thumping and playing loud music. She wasn't friendly. She didn't even like to say hi in passing. That's just how she was. She moved into the cabin, and that's where she stayed.
You said she was found at the cabin. Do the police think she died there as well?
I believe so. Like I said, she wasn't found for some time. Nearly 2 weeks, they think, from the state she was in. I hadn't heard from her, but I didn't think much about it. I'd talked to her on a Thursday night, and she told me she was taking off. I assumed she meant that night, but she didn't say as much, at least not that I remember. If you recall, spring came late last year, and the pollen count was high, which meant her allergies were acting up. Anyway, she called and said she'd be out of town for 2 weeks. She was taking time off from work and said she was driving up to the mountains to see whatever snows were left. Ski country was the only place she found relief when she was suffering. She said she'd call when she got back, and that was the last I talked to her.
I'd begun to scribble notes.
What date was this?
April 19th. The body was discovered May 5th.
Where was she going? Did she give you her destination?
She mentioned the mountains, but she never did say where. You think that makes a difference?
I'm just curious, I replied. April seems late for snow. It could have been a cover story if she was going somewhere else. Did you get the impression she was concealing something?
Oh, Lorna's not the kind who confided details. My other two, if they're going off on vacation, we all sit around poring over the travel brochures and hotel accommodations. Like right now, Berlin's saving her money for a trip, and we're always talking about this cruise versus that, ooing and aahing. The fantasy's half the fun is the way I look at it.
Lorna said that just set up a lot of expectations, and then reality would disappoint. She didn't look at anything the way other people did. At any rate, when I didn't hear from her, I figured she was out of town. She wasn't one to call much anyway, and none of us would have any reason to go to her place if she was gone.
She hesitated, embarrassed.
I can tell I feel guilty. Just listen to how much explanation I'm going into here. I just don't want it to seem like I didn't care.
It doesn't sound like that.
That's good, because I love that child more than life itself.
Tears rose briefly, almost like a reflex, and I could see her blink them away.
Anyway, it was someone she'd done some work for who finally went back there.
What was her name?
Oh, Serena Bonney.
I glanced at my notes. She's the nurse?
That's right.
What kind of work had Lorna done for her?
She house sat. Lorna looked after Mrs. Bonney's dad sometimes. As I understand it, the old fellow wasn't well, and Mrs. Bonney didn't like leaving him by himself. I guess she was trying to make arrangements to leave town and wanted to talk to Lorna before she made reservations. Lorna didn't have an answering machine. Mrs. Bonney called several times and then decided to leave a note on her front door.
Once she got close, she realized something was wrong.
Janice broke off, not with emotion, but with the unpleasant images that must have been conjured up. After 2 weeks undiscovered, the body would have been in very poor shape.
How did Lorna die? Was there a determination as to cause of death?
Well, that's the point. They never did find out. She was lying face down on the floor in her underwear, with her sweat clothes strewn nearby. I guess she'd come back from a run and stripped down for her shower, but it didn't seem like she'd been assaulted. It's always possible she suffered an asthma attack.
But you don't believe it.
No, I don't, and the police didn't either.
She was into exercise? I find that surprising from what you've told me so far.
Oh, she liked to keep in shape. I do know there were times when a workout made her wheezy and kind of short of breath, but she had one of those inhalers, and it seemed to help. If she had a bad spell, she'd cut back on exercise and then take it up again when she was feeling better. Doctors didn't want her to act like an invalid.
What about the autopsy?
Report's right in here, she said, indicating the paper bag.
There were no signs of violence?
Janice shook her head. I don't know how to say this. I guess because of putrefaction, they weren't even sure it was her at first. It wasn't until they compared her dental records that she was identified.
I'm assuming the case was handled as a homicide.
Well, yes. Even with cause of death undetermined, it was considered suspicious. They investigated as a homicide, but then nothing turned up. Now it seems like they dropped it. You know how they do those things. Something else comes along and they concentrate on that.
Sometimes there isn't sufficient information to make a finding in a situation like that. It doesn't mean they haven't worked hard.
Well, I understand, but I still can't accept it.
I noticed that she had ceased to make eye contact, and I could feel the whisper of intuition crawling up along my spine. I found myself focusing on her face, wondering at her apparent uneasiness.
Janice, is there something you haven't told me?
Her cheeks began to tint as if she were being overtaken by a hot flash.
I was just getting to that.
Chapter 2. She reached into the brown paper bag again and pulled out a videotape in an unmarked box that she placed on the edge of the desk.
About a month ago, someone sent us this tape, she said. I still don't know who, and I can't think why they'd do it except to cause us distress. Mace wasn't home. I found it in the mailbox in a plain brown wrapper with no return address. I opened the package because it had both our names on it. I went ahead and stuck it in the VCR. I don't know what I thought it was, a tape of some television show or somebody's wedding. I about died when I saw. Tape was pure smut, and there was Lorna, big as life. I just let out this shriek. I turned it off and threw it in the trash as fast as I could. It was like I'd been burned. I felt like I should go wash my hands in the sink. But then I had second thoughts, because this tape could be evidence. It might tie into the reason she was killed.
I leaned forward. Let me clarify one point before you go on. This was the first you'd heard of it? You had no idea she was involved in anything like this?
Absolutely not. I was floored. Pornography? There's no way. Of course, once I saw what it was, I began to wonder if somebody put her up to it.
Like what? I don't understand, I said.
She might have been blackmailed. She might have been coerced. For all we know, she was working undercover for the police, which they would never admit.
What makes you say that?
For the first time, she was sounding off, and I felt myself step back, viewing her with caution.
Because we'd sue them, that's why. If she got killed in the line of duty, we'd go after them.
I sat and stared at her.
Janice, I worked for the Santa Teresa Police Department myself for 2 years. They're serious professionals. They don't enlist the services of amateurs. In a vice investigation? I find that hard to believe.
I didn't say they did. I didn't accuse anyone because that would be slander or libel or one of them. I'm just telling you it's possible.
Such as?
She seemed to hesitate, thinking about it. Well, maybe she was about to blow the whistle on whoever made the film.
To what end? It's not against the law to make a pornographic film these days.
But couldn't it be a cover for something else? Some other kind of crime?
Sure, it could, but let's back up a minute and let me play devil's advocate here. You told me the cause of death was undetermined, which means the coroner's office couldn't say with any certainty what she died of, right? Reluctantly.
That's right.
How do you know she didn't have an aneurysm or a stroke or a heart attack? With all the allergies she suffered, she might have died from anaphylactic shock.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but you're making a big leap here without a shred of proof.
I understand. I guess it sounds crazy to you, but I know what I know. She was murdered, I'm absolutely sure of it, but I can't get anyone to listen, and what am I supposed to do? I'll tell you something else. She had quite a lot of money at the time she died.
How much?
Close to $500,000 worth of stocks and bonds. She had some money in CDs, but the bulk was in securities. She had 5 or 6 different savings accounts, too. Now, where'd she get that?
How do you think she acquired it?
Maybe somebody paid her off to keep quiet about something.
I studied the woman, trying to assess her powers of reasoning. First, she claimed her daughter was being blackmailed or coerced. Now she was suggesting she was guilty of extortion. I set the issue aside temporarily and shifted my focus.
How did the police react to the tape?
Dead silence. I said, Janice? Her expression was stubborn.
I didn't take it to them. I wouldn't even show it to Mace because he'd die of embarrassment. Lorna was his angel. He'd never be the same if he knew what she'd done.
She picked up the tape and put it back in the paper bag, folding the top down protectively.
But why not show it to the cops? At least it would give them a fresh avenue.
She was already shaking her head.
No, ma'am. No way. I'd never in this world turn it over to them. I know better. That's the last we'd ever see of it. I know it sounds paranoid, but I've heard of cases like this. Evidence they don't like disappears into thin air. Get to court and it's mysteriously vanished. Period. End of paragraph. I don't trust police. That's the point.
Why trust me? How do you know I'm not in cahoots with them?
I have to trust someone. I want to know how she got into this blue movie stuff. If it's why she was killed.
But I'm not trained. I can't go back in time and figure out what happened. I have no way to do that.
She took a deep breath and changed gears. Anyway, I decided if I hired an investigator, that's the person I'd give the tape to. I guess now I have to ask if you're willing to help, because if you're not, I'll have to find someone else.
I thought about it briefly. Of course I was interested. I just wasn't sure about my chances of success.
An investigation like this is likely to be expensive. Are you prepared for that?
I wouldn't have come up if I wasn't.
And your husband's in agreement?
He's not wild about the idea, but he can see I'm determined.
All right. Let me nose around first before we sign any contracts. I want to make sure I can do you some good. Otherwise, it's a waste of my time and your money.
Are you going to talk to the police?
I'll have to do that, I said.
Maybe unofficially at first. The point is, I need information, and if we can get their cooperation, it will save you some bucks.
I understand that, she said. But you have to understand one thing, too. I know you feel the police here are competent, and I'm sure that's true, but everybody makes an occasional mistake, and it's just human nature to want to cover it up. I don't want you to decide whether or not you can help on the basis of their attitude. They probably think I'm crazy as a loon.
Believe me, I'm capable of making up my own mind about things.
I could feel a crick in my neck, and I took a look at my watch. Time to wind it up, I thought. I asked for her home address, her home phone, and the number at the coffee shop, making notes on my legal pad.
Let me see what I can find out, I said. In the meantime, you can leave that with me? I'd like to get myself up to speed. The meter won't actually start ticking until we have a signed contract.
She glanced down at the paper sack beside her, but made no move to lift it.
I guess so. I suppose. I wouldn't want anybody else to get their hands on the tape. It'd kill Mace and the girls if they knew what was in here.
I crossed my heart and held my hand up.
I'll guard it with my life, I said.
I didn't think there was any point in reminding her that pornography is a commercial venture. There were probably thousands of copies of the tape in circulation.
I tucked the notes in my briefcase and snapped the lid down.
She stood up when I did, hefting the bag to one hip before she passed it over to me.
Thanks, I said.
I picked up my jacket and my handbag, setting them on top of the bag, juggling the armload of items as I turned off lights. She followed me across the hall and watched me uneasily as I locked up. I glanced back at her.
You're going to have to trust me, you know. Without that, there's no point doing business together.
She nodded, and I caught a glimpse of tears in her eyes.
I hope you remember Lorna really wasn't like what you see.
I'll remember, I said. I'll get back to you as soon as I know anything, and we'll work out a game plan.
All right. One more thing. You're going to have to tell Mace about the tape. He doesn't have to see it, but he should know it exists. I want complete honesty among the three of us.
All right. Anyway, I've never been good at keeping secrets from him.
We parted company in the little 12-car parking lot behind the building, after which I drove home. Once in my neighborhood, I had to circle the block before I snagged a semi-legal spot half a block away. I locked my car and walked to my place, toting the paper sack like a load of groceries. The night was downy and soft. The street was darkened by trees, the bare branches woven overhead in a loose canopy. The few stars I saw were as bright as ice chips flung across the sky. The ocean rumbled along the winter beach half a block away. I could smell salt like wood smoke on the still night air. Ahead of me, a light glowed in the window of my second-story loft, and I could see the wind-tossed pine boughs tapping at the glass. A man on a bicycle passed me, dressed in dark clothes, moving quickly, the heels of his cycling shoes marked by strips of reflector tape. He made no sound, except for the soft hum of air through his spokes. I found myself staring after him, as if he were an apparition. I pushed through the gate, which swung shut behind me with a comforting squeak. When I reached the backyard, I glanced at my landlord's kitchen window automatically, though I knew it would be dark. Henry had gone back to Michigan to see his family and wouldn't return for another couple of weeks. I was keeping an eye on his place, bringing in his newspaper and sorting through his mail, sending on anything that seemed critical. As usual, I found myself surprised at how much I missed him. I'd first met Henry Pitts 4 years ago, when I was looking for a studio apartment. I'd been raised primarily in trailer parks, where I lived with my maiden aunt after the death of my parents when I was 5 years old. In my 20s, two brief marriages did little to promote my sense of permanence. After Aunt Jin's death, I moved back into her rented trailer, retreating into the solace of that compact space. I had by then left the Santa Teresa Police Department, and I was working for the man who taught me much of what I know now about private investigation. Once I was licensed and had set up an office of my own, I occupied a series of single and double wides in various Santa Teresa trailer parks, the last of these being the Mountain View Mobile Home Estates out in the suburb of Colgate. I probably would have gone on living there indefinitely, except that I'd been evicted along with a number of my neighbors. Several parks in the area, the Mountain View among them, had converted to seniors, 55 and older only, and the courts were in the process of reviewing all the discrimination suits that had been filed as a result. I didn't have the patience to wait for an outcome, so I began to make the rounds of the available studio rentals. Armed with newspaper ads and a map of the city, I drove from one sorry listing to the next. The search was discouraging. Anything in my price range, which ran all the way from very cheap to extremely modest, was either badly located, filthy, dirty, or in complete disrepair. Let's don't even talk about the issues of charm or character. I chanced on Henry's ad posted at the laundromat and checked it out only because I was in the area. I can still remember the first day I parked my VW and pushed my way through Henry's squeaking gate. It was March, and a light rain had varnished the streets, perfuming the air with the smell of wet grass and narcissus. The flowering cherry trees were in bloom, pink blossoms littering the sidewalk out in front. The studio had been a single-car garage, converted into a tiny bachelorette, which almost exactly duplicated the kind of quarters I was used to. From the outside, the place was completely nondescript. The garage had been connected to the main house by means of an open breezeway that Henry had glassed in, most days using the space to proof mammoth batches of bread dough.
He's a retired commercial baker and still rises early and bakes almost daily. His kitchen window was open, and the smells of yeast, cinnamon, and simmering spaghetti sauce wafted out across the sill into the mild spring air. Before I knocked and introduced myself, I cupped my hands against the studio window and peered in at the space. At that time, there was really only one large room, 17 feet on a side, with a narrow bump-out for a small bath and a galley-style kitchenette. This space has been enlarged now to accommodate a sleeping loft and a second bathroom above. Even then, in its original state, one glance was all it took to know that I was home. Henry had answered the door wearing a white T-shirt and shorts, flip-flops on his feet, a rag tied around his head. His hands were powdered with flour, and he had a smudge of white on his forehead. I took in the sight of his narrow, tanned face, his white hair and his bright blue eyes, wondering if I'd known him in a life before this one. He invited me in, and while we talked, he fed me the first of the countless homemade cinnamon rolls I've consumed in his kitchen since. Apparently, he'd interviewed just about as many applicants as I had landlords. He was looking for a tenant without kids, vile personal habits, or an affinity for loud music. I was looking for a landlord who would mind his own business. I found Henry appealing because at his 80-some years, I figured I was safe from unwanted attentions. I probably appealed to him because I was such a misanthrope. I'd spent 2 years as a cop and another 2 years amassing the 4,000 hours required to apply for my private investigator's license. I'd been duly photographed, fingerprinted, bonded, and credentialed. Since my principal means of employment involved exposure to the underside of human nature, I tended even then to keep other people at a distance. I have since learned to be polite. I can even appear friendly when it suits my purposes, but I'm not really known for my cute girlish ways. Being a loner, I'm an ideal neighbor. Quiet, reclusive, unobtrusive, and gone a lot. I unlocked my door and flipped on the downstairs lights, shed my jacket, turned on the TV, pressed the power button for the VCR, and slid Lorna Kepler's video into the machine. I don't see any point in going into excruciating detail about the contents of the tape. Suffice it to say the storyline was simple and there was no character development. In addition, the acting was atrocious, and there was much simulated sex of a sort more ludicrous than lewd. Maybe it was only my discomfort at the subject that made the whole enterprise seem amateurish. It surprised me to see the credits, which I rewound and read again from the beginning. There was a producer, a director, and an editor whose names sounded real: Joseph Ayers, Morton Castlebaum, and Chester Ellis. I put the tape on hold while I jotted them down, then reactivated the play button and let the tape roll again. I expected the actors to have monikers like Biff Mandate, Cherry Ravish, and Randy Bottoms. But Lorna Kepler was listed, along with two others, Russell Turpin and Nancy Dobbs, whose quite ordinary names I made note of in passing. There didn't seem to be a writer, but then I suppose pornographic sex really doesn't require much in the way of scripting. The narrative would make bizarre reading in any event. I wondered where the film had been shot. Given what I imagined to be a pornographic film budget, no one was going to rent the locations or apply for any permits. For the most part, scenes took place in interiors that could have been anywhere. The lead actor, Russell Turpin, must have been hired solely on the basis of certain personal attributes that he displayed fore and aft. He and Nancy, ostensibly husband and wife, were sprawled naked on their living room couch, exchanging bad dialogue and subjecting each other to various sexual indignities. Nancy was awkward, her gaze straying to a spot at the left of camera where someone was clearly mouthing the lines she was supposed to say. I've seen elementary school pageants with more talent and evidence. Whatever passion she conjured up looked like something she'd learned from watching other pornographic film clips, the chief gesture being a lascivious lip-licking more likely to cause chapping than arousal, in my opinion. I suspect she was actually hired because she was the only one who owned a real garter belt in this age of pantyhose. Lorna was the prime focus, and her appearance was staged for maximum effect. She seemed oblivious of the camera, her movements fluid and unhurried, her expertise undisguised. Her looks were elegant, and in the early moments of her role it was difficult to imagine the misbehaviors that would soon emerge. At first she was cool and seemed to be secretly amused. Later she was shameless, controlled, and intense, totally focused on herself and whatever she was feeling. Early in the viewing, I was inclined to fast-forward past any scene not involving her, but the effect became comical. The perils of Pauline with sex parts flapping back and forth. I tried to watch with the same detachment I affected homicide sites, but the mechanism failed, and I found myself squirming. I do not take lightly the degradation of human beings, especially when it's done solely for the financial gain of others. I've heard it said that the pornography industry is larger than the record and the film industries combined, staggering sums of money changing hands in the name of sex. At least this video had little violence and no scenes involving children or animals of any kind. While there wasn't much story to speak of, the director had made an attempt to create suspense. Lorna played a sexually demonic apparition, and as such stalked both husband and wife, who ran stark naked through the house. She was also sexually abusive to a repairman named Harry, who showed up in the film during one of the parts I skipped the first time. Often Lorna's appearances were heralded by smoke, and her diaphanous gown was blown skyward by a wind machine. Once the action began, there were many close shots, lovingly detailed by a cameraman with a passion for his zoom lens. I flicked the tape off and rewound it, turning my attention to the packaging. The production company was called Cyrenaic Cinema, with a San Francisco address. Cyrenaic? What did that mean? I pulled my dictionary from the shelf and checked the reference. Cyrenaic, of the Greek school of philosophy founded by Aristippus of Cyrene, who considered individual sensual pleasure the greatest good. Well, someone was literate. I tried directory assistance in the 415 area code. There was no telephone number listed, but the address might be good. Even if Janice and I came to an agreement, I wasn't sure she'd want to fund a trip to San Francisco. I sorted through the files she'd given me, separating out the news clippings from the police reports. I read the autopsy report with particular care, translating the technicalities into my sketchy layman's understanding. The basic facts were about as distasteful as the film I'd just seen, without the leavening influence of all the corny dialogue. By the time Lorna's body was discovered, the process of decomposition was virtually complete. Gross examination revealed precious little of significance, as all the soft tissue had collapsed into a greasy mass. Maggots had made hasty work of her. Internal examination confirmed the absence of all organs, with only small amounts of tissue left representing the GI tract, the liver, and the circulatory system. Brain tissue was also completely liquefied and or absent. Osseous remains showed no evidence of blunt force, trauma, no stab or gunshot wounds, no ligature, no crushed or broken bones. Two old fractures were noted, but neither apparently pertained to the manner of her death. What laboratory tests could be run showed no drugs or poisons in her system. Complete dental arches were excised and retained, along with all 10 fingers. Positive identification was made through dental charts and a residual print from the right thumb. There were no photographs, but I suspected those would be attached to her department file. Post-mortem glossies would hardly have been passed along to her mother. There was no way to pinpoint date or time of death, but a rough estimate was made from several environmental factors. Countless people interviewed testified as to her night owl tendencies. It was also allegedly her habit to jog shortly after she got up. As nearly as the homicide investigators could establish, she'd slept late as usual on that Saturday, April 21st. She'd then pulled on her sweats and had gone out for a jog. The Saturday morning paper was in, as was the mail that had been delivered late that morning. All the mail and newspapers after the 21st were piled up unopened. Idly, I wondered why she hadn't left for her trip Thursday night as planned. Maybe she'd finished out the work week on Friday, intending to take off Saturday morning once she was showered and dressed. The questions were obvious, but it was useless to speculate in the absence of concrete evidence. While the cause of death was undetermined, the police had proceeded on the assumption that she'd been struck down by a person or persons unknown. Lorna had lived alone and in singular isolation. If she'd cried out for help, there had been none within range of her. I'm single myself, and though Henry Pitts lives close by, I'm sometimes uneasy. There's a certain vulnerability attached to my work. I've been variously shot, pummeled, punched, and accosted, but I've usually found a way to outmaneuver my attackers. I didn't like the idea of Lorna's final moments. The homicide detective who'd done all the grunt work was a guy named Cheney Phillips, whom I ran into from time to time. The last I'd heard, he'd moved from homicide to vice. I'm not really sure how law enforcement agencies in other cities work, but in the Santa Teresa Police Department, officers tend to be rotated every 2 to 3 years, exposing them to a variety of responsibilities. This not only ensures a well-balanced department, but allows the opportunity for advancement without an officer's having to wait for the death or retirement of division-entrenched colleagues. Like many cops in town, Phillips could usually be found in a local watering hole called CC's, which was frequented by attorneys and a variety of law enforcement types. His supervisor on the case had been Lieutenant Con Dolan, whom I knew very well. I was somewhat skeptical that Lorna's role in a low-budget movie was related to her death. On the other hand, I could see why Janice Kepler wanted to believe as much. What else are you going to think when it turns out your late and favorite daughter was a pornographic film star? I was restless, nearly itchy with an overdose of caffeine. I'd probably sucked down 8 to 10 cups of coffee during the day, the last 2 that evening while I was talking to Janice. Now I could feel stimulants, like sugar plums, dancing in my head. Sometimes anxiety and caffeine have the same effect. I checked my watch again. It was after midnight by now, and well past my bedtime. I pulled out the phone book and found the number for CC's. The call took less than 15 seconds. The bartender told me Cheney Phillips was on the premises. I gave him my name and had him give Cheney the message that I was on my way. As I hung up the phone, I could hear him yelling to Cheney across the din. I grabbed my jacket and my keys and headed out the door. Chapter 3. I drove east along Cabana, the wide boulevard that parallels the beach. When the moon is full, the darkness has the quality of a film scene shot day for night. The landscape is so highly illuminated that the trees actually cast shadows. Tonight the moon was in its final quarter, rising low in the sky. From the road I couldn't see the ocean, but I could hear the reverberating rumble of the tide rolling in. There was just enough wind to set the palm trees in motion, shaggy heads nodding together in some secret communication. A car passed me, going in the opposite direction, but there were no pedestrians in sight. I'm not often out at such an hour, and it was curiously exhilarating. By day, Santa Teresa seems like any small Southern California town. Churches and businesses hug the ground against the threat of earthquakes. The roof lines are low, and the architectural influence is largely Spanish. There's something solid and reassuring about all the white adobe and the red tile roofs. Lawns are manicured, and the shrubs are crisply trimmed. By night, the same features seem stark and dramatic, full of black and white contrasts that lend intensity to the hardscape. The sky at night isn't really black at all. It's a soft charcoal gray, nearly chalky with light pollution, the trees like ink stains on a darkened carpet. Even the wind has a different feel to it, as light as a feather quilt against the skin. The real name for CC's is the Caliente Café, a low-rent establishment housed in an abandoned service station near the railroad tracks. The original gasoline pumps and the storage tanks below had been removed years before, and the contaminated soil had been paved over with asphalt.
Now, on hot days, the blacktop tends to soften, and a toxic syrup seeps out. A tarry liquid quickly converted into wisps of smoke, suggesting that the tarmac is on the verge of bursting into flames. Winters, the pavement cracks from dry cold, and a sulfurous smell wafts across the parking lot. CC's is not the kind of place to encourage bare feet. I parked out in front beneath a sizzling red neon sign. Outside, the air smelled like corn tortillas fried in lard. Inside, like salsa and recirculated cigarette smoke. I could hear the high-pitched whine of a blender working overtime, whipping ice and tequila into the margarita mix. The Caliente Café bills itself as an authentic Mexican cantina, which means the decor consists of Mexican sombreros tacked above the doors. Bad lighting eliminates the need for anything else. Every item on the menu has been Americanized, and all the names are cute. Ensenada Ensalada, Pasta Pequeño, Linguini Bambini. The music, all canned, is usually played way too loud, like a band of mariachis hired to hover at your table while you try to eat. Cheney Phillips was sitting at the bar, his face tilted in my direction. My request for an audience had clearly piqued his interest. Cheney was probably in his early 30s, a white guy with a disheveled mop of dark curly hair, dark eyes, good chin, prickly two-day growth of beard. His was the sort of face you might see in a men's fashion magazine or the society section of the local papers, escorting some debutante decked out like a bride. He was slim, of medium height, wearing a tobacco-brown silk sport coat over a white dress shirt, his pants a pleated cream-colored gabardine. His air of confidence suggested money of intimidating origins. Everything about him said trust fund, private schools, and casual West Coast privilege. This is pure projection on my part, and I have no idea if it's accurate. I've never really asked him how he ended up a cop. For all I know, he's third-generation law enforcement with all the women in his family doing jail administration. I eased up onto the bar stool next to his. "Hello, Cheney. How are you? Thanks for waiting. I appreciate it." He shrugged. "I'm usually here until closing time anyway. Can I buy you a drink?" "Of course. I'm so wired on coffee I may never get to sleep." "What's your pleasure?"
"Chardonnay, if you please."
"Absolutely," he said.
He smiled, revealing first-rate orthodontic work. No one could have teeth that straight without years of expensive correction.
Cheney's manner was habitually seductive, and never more so than in a setting such as this. The bartender had been watching our interchange with an exaggerated late-night patience. In a bar like CC's, this was the hour when the sexually desperate made their last-minute appeals for company. By then, enough liquor had been consumed that potential partners who earlier had been rejected as unworthy were now being reconsidered. The bartender apparently assumed we were negotiating a one-night relationship. Cheney ordered wine for me and another vodka tonic for himself. He checked back over his shoulder, doing a quick visual survey of the other patrons.
"You ought to keep an eye on all the off-duty police officers. Last call, we go out in the parking lot and pass around a breathalyzer, like we're copping a joint. Make sure we're still sober enough to drive ourselves home."
"I heard you left Homicide."
"Right. I've been doing Vice for 6 months."
"Well, that suits," I said. "Do you like it?"
He'd probably been moved to Vice because he still looked young enough to have some.
"Sure, it's great. It's a one-man department. I'm the current expert on gambling, prostitution, drugs, and organized crime, such as it is in Santa Teresa." "What about you? What are you up to? You probably didn't come down here to chat about my career in law enforcement."
He looked up as the bartender approached, halting further conversation until our drinks had been served. When he looked back, I said,
"Janice Kepler wants to hire me to look into her daughter's death."
"Good luck," he said.
"You handled the original investigation, yes?"
"Dolan and me, with a couple more guys thrown in. This is the long and short of it," he said, ticking the items off his fingers. "There was no way to determine cause of death. We still aren't absolutely certain what day it was, let alone what time frame. There was no significant trace evidence, no witnesses, no motive, no suspects."
And no case, I supplied.
You got it. Either this was not a homicide to begin with, or the killer led a charmed life.
I'll say.
You going to do it?
Don't know yet. Thought I'd better talk to you first.
Have you seen a picture of her? She was beautiful. Screwed up, but gorgeous. Talk about a dark side, my God.
Like what?
She had this part-time job at the water treatment plant. She's a clerk typist, you know. She does a little phone work, a little filing, maybe 4 hours a day. She tells everybody she's working her way through City College, which is true in its way. She takes a class now and then, but it's only half the story. What she's really up to is a bit of high-class hooking. She's making $1,500 a pop. We're talking substantial sums of money at the time of her death.
Who'd she work for?
Nobody. She was independent. She started doing outcall, exotic dance and massage. Guys phone this service listed in the classifieds, and she goes out and does some kind of bump and grind strip while they abuse themselves. The game is you can't make a deal for more than that up front. Undercover used to call and pull that till everybody wised up. But once she's on the premises, she can negotiate whatever services the client wants. It's strictly their transaction.
For which she gets paid what?
Cheney shrugged. Depends on what she does. Straight sex is probably $150, which she ends up splitting with the management. Pretty quick, she figures out she has more on the ball. So she bags the cheap gigs and moves up to the big time.
Here in town?
For the most part. I understand they used to see quite a bit of her in the bar at the Edgewater Hotel. She also cruised through Bubbles in Montebello, which you probably heard was closed down last July. She had a penchant for the places where the high rollers hung out.
Did her mother know this?
Sure she did. Absolutely. Lorna was even picked up once on a misdemeanor for soliciting an undercover vice officer at Bubbles. We didn't want to rub her mother's nose in the fact, but she was certainly informed.
Maybe it's just beginning to sink in, I said. Someone sent her a copy of a pornographic film in which Lorna loomed large. Apparently, that's what prompted her to come see me. She thinks Lorna was either blackmailed into it or working undercover.
Oh, yeah, right, he said. I'm just telling you her assumption.
Cheney snorted.
She's in denial big time. Have you actually seen this tape?
I just saw it tonight. It was pretty raunchy.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how much difference it makes. The kind of stuff she was into, it really doesn't surprise me.
How's it supposed to tie in? That's the part I don't get. Janice thinks Lorna was about to blow the whistle on someone.
Oh, man, that lady's seen too many bad TV movies. Blow the whistle on who and for what? Those people are legitimate, in some sense of the word. They're probably scumbags, but that's not against the law in this state. Look at all the politicians.
That's what I told her. Anyway, I'm trying to figure out if there's enough to warrant my taking on the job. If you guys couldn't come up with anything, how can I?
Maybe you'll get lucky. I'm one of life's eternal optimists.